Hey, if you're enjoying this show, consider supporting us on our Patreon. You can get cool perks like access to these episodes a week before they go public, and you can pick an album for us to review. Any support is greatly appreciated, so if you feel inclined, go to patreon.com/polyphonicpress.
You're listening to Polyphonic Press, a podcast for music lovers. Join your hosts, Jeremy Boyd and John Van Dyke, as they take a deep dive into a classic album and analyze it track by track.
Hi, welcome to Polyphonic Press. I'm Jeremy Boyd.
I'm John Van Dyke.
And so this is episode number two.
Dos.
Numero dos. I don't know what to say other than this has been fun.
So far. We're just more trying to figuring out our sound equipment.
Yeah.
That's fine. You know, there's still bugs to work out, but we'll get them.
Yeah, exactly. So last week was interesting. I'd never heard that whole album before, the Joshua Tree. That was really cool. And, I'm interested to hear what band we're going to be talking about this week.
We shall consult the randomizer.
So without further ado,
okie doke,
I will press the button and see what album we're going to be listening to this week.
Awesome. Drum roll, please.
Okay. Ooh. So we're going to be listening to this week, The Grateful Dead and their album Anthem of the Sun.
Hmm.
Okay. So first of all, I don't know much about The Grateful Dead.
I just know they've got a cult following that will literally follow them from city to city,
mm-hmm.
or at least they did back when they were touring.
Yes. Well, I think they're still going. Well, there's an iteration of The Dead that's still going.
There's an iteration of The Dead, which seems to be, what the hell's the hex's name? Bob Weir, and he's doing a lot of touring with Phish, because mm-hmm. that just makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or at least they were before all this crap hit, you know.
And I think John Mayer is touring with them right now.
That's interesting. Dude's a good guitar player, actually.
He is.
That might be kind of cool, actually.
I don't like his guitar face. It can be annoying sometimes.
Yeah.
But anyway, I'm curious because I want to see what this album is. The only Grateful Dead album that I know is American Beauty.
I'm sort of interested in some of their like really early stuff.
Yeah.
I wonder where this one kind of falls in. Again, I'm no expert on them either.
Anthem of the Sun. So this is their second
68.
Record. 1968.
Yes, good. This is one of the ones on the list that I wanted. I was very interested in.
Okay.
So here we go.
Yeah. So let's see. So, okay. So I'm just reading from Wikipedia here. So Anthem of the Sun is the second album by rock band The Grateful Dead, released in 1968 on Warner Brothers 7 Arts.
I think we're just going to have to play it.
So let me get... Okay, so let's get into the Anthem of the Sun. This is going to be kind of a long one. There's a song that's 11 minutes and 20 seconds.
Yeah, but how many tracks are there?
There's 5.
Oh, well, that's your standard long tracks, but short track list.
Yeah, well...
album of the late 60s, early 70s.
Exactly.
It's going to be all right. It's like listening to... most Deep Purple records are like that.
That's true. I guess it's the same length... as an average album. It's just the songs themselves are longer.
Yeah.
Cool. Okay. So let's get into this. I'm guessing, because it says that's it for the other one, which is the first song on the album, parts 1 through 4. So I'm guessing this is like a mini opera symphony kind of thing. Okay. Cool. Okay, so this is That's It for the Other One, parts 1 through 4. Okay, so the I guess that track leads into the next one. So I'm just pausing it as it's leading into the next one.
Yeah.
I like it.
That was strange.
Yeah, it was really odd. Actually, I'm wondering, like, there was a couple of times where it sounded like there was static coming through in some places. Was that actually part of the track, or was that,
I think,
like,
so.
Just...
Yeah, there, wow. Yeah, towards the end there, yeah.
That was truly psychedelic.
That's a word for it.
Yes.
But you know what? It's not that weird in, like, it's not that different than jazz, really.
Oh, no, absolutely. Well, you know, some of the more freeform jazz, I mean, we've always known that, you know, bands like the Grateful Dead there was a lot of jazz influence going into a lot of bands around that period. That's just one of the things they would, reference in many cases.
Mm-hmm.
Prog rock bands would do things like that, as well as classical. And I think the Grateful Dead sort of, you know, I mean, we know them as a jam band and much like the Allman Brothers sense, but they were a little more of a, well, they were your San Francisco psychedelic group for sure, but they had a little bit more of a different, they were a bit of a prog band at times.
Yeah, but I would also argue that I jam bands and jazz are more related than they are distant.
Probably.
Especially, I noticed, especially the way that they were playing the drums. That's a very jazz style of playing the drums.
Mm-hmm.
And Jerry Garcia's guitar playing is very jazz influenced. Like those lines that he was playing were very, very much influenced by jazz guitar players. But then, I was kind of right that it was kind of like a mini opera,
mm-hmm.
and it went through different phases, I guess, or movements, I guess you could call them.
Yeah.
And, but then towards the end, it just kind of devolved into
cacophony.
Something. Yeah.
Cacophony, or I don't know. Pronounced one of those ways.
But you know, I was listening to it and it's not that far off as well. And I can kind of hear the influence of some of the stuff that Brian Wilson was doing on, like, Pet Sounds.
Yeah, absolutely. And Smile.
Yeah.
Wouldn't come out for a good 50 years.
Yeah. Yeah. But you can definitely hear that experimentation, that influence in this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, let's listen to the track that it was going to bleed into.
Yes, the next track is called New New Potato Caboose.
That's, yeah. Sweet.
So, strap.
Oh, yeah, that's good shit.
Strap in and let's hear the New Potato Caboose. Man, this album so far is a roller coaster.
Yeah.
There's parts where I absolutely hate it, and there's parts where I'm going, this is awesome.
Yeah. Well, I'm pretty used to some pretty strange stuff, so there's nothing here that I hate, but there's, like, I can tolerate a certain amount of cacophony because I've listened to those tons and tons of psychedelic albums and tracks and stuff where they do the strangest shit you can think of. And I'm kind of into that. You know, their ideas, they're crazy, they're wild, they're out there. I'll throw them in my playlist and they're just sort of mixed in there. This is probably going in there itself. But yeah, that last song was... That's more what you would consider. That's what you think of when you think of the Grateful Dead. You think of a jam.
Yeah.
And that's a really good one, too.
Yeah, that was. That obviously not all improvised. They have...
there's a basic structure they sort of dance around.
Yeah. But a lot of it is improvised. And what I liked about the mix is you had the two drummers in one in the left ear and one in the right ear. That was pretty cool. And
I think that's the best way to recover. If you got two drummers, that's the best way to do it.
Yeah.
Because then they play, you know, you got sort of like this. It's like double tracking vocals, but you're double tracking the percussion.
Yeah.
It's pretty sweet.
Yeah.
Actually.
It's more like an orchestra in that way. And there are only, I can only think of a handful of bands that have two drummers. Obviously, the Grateful Dead and the Allman Brothers.
King Gizzard has two.
I know I've seen a few others, but it's a rare thing to have two drummers.
It's pretty, it really takes a certain amount of, again, you have to play with space. You don't want your drummers to be too busy. Mm-hmm. I mean, they can be fast, but they got to really kind of like between a bass player and a drummer, though probably even more so, they really got to be in step with each other. Otherwise, it can be downright cacophony. It'll sound like, you know, the end of the first track a little bit.
Just a jumbled.
But not intentionally.
Right, just a jumbled mess of, I don't know where we're going, what are we doing?
Yeah, it can come off sounding very busy if you don't know what you're doing.
Yeah. But this is a really good display of what this band can do in terms of their musicianship and playing off of each other. I liked some of the bass lines that Phil Lesh was doing. Just some of the going kind of up and down the neck was really cool.
Yeah. Yeah, this is I can tell that if I go back and listen to it again, there's going to be a whole lot of stuff that I didn't hear the first time through. You could and you probably do that. You could probably listen to it 50 times and still find new stuff. It's just so much going on, but it's not busy. It's just you got new Easter eggs every time you go through it and go, "Oh, well, that was cool."
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then some of the parts that I didn't like were I think just some of the studio noise that they were doing towards the beginning. And it's not that I don't like that stuff. It's just sometimes it can go on for a little too long before I can.
That's fair.
Stop doing this. This is boring. What are you doing?
Well, you know, I'm sure there was a lot of interesting influences being passed around the room at the time. I mean, they're kind of notorious for this.
Maybe it helps to be on those substances while you're listening to it.
I mean, certainly.
Yeah.
Although, again, I've been pretty blessed with a brain that can get behind it even without the substances within my system. It's a bit of a ride. So, yeah, I don't know. I'm all for it.
Yeah.
I'm on board.
I mean, I'm used to the jams. Like, I listened to, like, the Black Crowes. They, you know, jam all the time. And I got into some jam bands when I was a teenager, like Fish and people like that. So I'm used to the jams. I'm used to the long jams. Like, I don't mind when a band goes on for like 20 minutes on the same song. That's not the stuff that that most people get bored with the Grateful Dead.
Yeah.
That's not the stuff that I don't like. Like I actually like all that stuff. It's just,
I kind of like it sometimes too. Although, at times I've thought that maybe, okay, this jam is starting to be a little on the long side. Like, that does happen. And I think everybody feels that. Even the band also suddenly feel that and go, okay, maybe we should wrap it up now.
Yeah, it's a certain energy that enters the room that I think everybody kind of, it's a collective feeling that, okay, this let's wrap it up.
We've all been there.
Yeah.
Whether it being in the audience or on the stage.
Yeah. So the next song is another long one at 2 minutes and 4 seconds. It's the shortest song on the album, but it's also a really short song at just over 2 minutes. And it's called Born Cross-Eyed. Okay, so that was kind of, I guess, the hit off the album. That was the song that was released as a single, or a B-side to a single.
Okay, that's interesting. It sounded like it needed some refining. I think it's a cool song,
mm-hmm.
but there was a little bit, I don't know, the production behind it sounded a little messy in places.
I agree. It sounds unfinished. It sounds like an idea of a song, but not a complete idea or a complete thing.
Yeah. But even, well, I think even if they had just, I don't know, more than clean it up, I think they needed a couple more takes of the song because, again, things were a little bit out of sync. Well, maybe there's a little bit of that going on too, but it seemed a little out of tune in places.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if, you know, they sort of really refined it a little bit, I know this isn't exactly the band's ethos, but I think that song kind of needed it.
Yeah. Well, I think the other songs are refined, but they're refined within the,
well, they get refined as they jam on them.
Yeah.
That's kind of how they do things.
Well, it's like the idea that the band is going for is all the other songs are like complete ideas and like, you know, well thought out. Mm-hmm. Even if it's improvised, it's like we're deliberately jamming here. This is what we're doing. In that sense, I think this, like, you're right. It sounds like they just kind of set up in the studio, hit record, and went through one take. And it's a song that they had, and they just did it, and then that was it. And it feels a bit like they had some more space on the album, so they just kind of threw it on.
It sounds a little bit, but it's interesting how they picked it to be their B-side.
Yeah. Well, it's a B-side to a single that was only released as a single.
Yes, exactly. But still, that's what they picked. I guess just because that's the only one we can fit on there.
Yeah.
So they put it on there. That's probably what they were thinking.
Yeah. Like, it's not, I don't think it's a terrible song.
Oh, I don't think it's terrible at all. I just think it needed a little bit more. You know, again, this is another thing. I probably learned to like it a lot more. And maybe it's just the way it's coming through. And maybe there's something being lost in there for me. I don't know. But I'm sure if I listen to it a few times, it's going to grow on me. And I do like the initial song. It seemed a little like they needed a couple more takes before they really got it.
Yeah.
Before they really nailed it.
Yeah, I agree. So the next one is the shortest song is followed by the longest song at 11 minutes and 20 seconds.
Remember, roller coaster.
A roller coaster, an absolute roller coaster. This one is called Alligator. So that, I was just reading about this song, or this album rather, and that song is a hybrid track. The first part was studio, and the second half was recorded live.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah. Okay. Hmm. It really did make it blend pretty seamlessly. Well, it says it's the 2001 remaster, so maybe they fixed it a little bit, and I don't know, I'd have to listen to the original record, but it to me, it sounded like they took the two tracks and blended them really, really seamlessly.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going to say, it's just, you could hear the beginning of the song sounded a lot like the Born Cross-Eyed track that we had, where it was a little bit like, it was a little unrehearsed or something like mm-hmm. that. But as it went on, and apparently this is amongst two tracks, you can really see where the band, where they shine is when they find that sound that they're doing after kind of just going through their parts and jamming for a while, where they just tighten up and tighten up and tighten up. And there's so many different parts of things going on and moving up, and then suddenly drums, and then the rest of the instrumentation comes in a little bit later, and then they're quite tight by the end of the thing. And it's a bit of a journey, but you can definitely tell that the band tightens up as they get towards the end of it. They're still never really tight because they're sort of a loose, kind of a laissez-faire kind of a, that's kind of what they want to be.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to be too rigid and stuff like that. That's not what they're about. And clearly it works for them because they've got a very loyal following. So, but yeah, you can definitely hear where they shine.
Yeah. Part of the studio part, one of the things that I noticed really early on, and I don't know if this was on purpose or not, but it sounded like the vocals were buried very deep in the mix and the instruments were up a lot higher. And I couldn't really make out what the lyrics were or what they were singing. I don't know if that was intentional or not. I didn't really care for it, to be honest. But maybe that's just my hang up about mixing and thinking that the vocals should be the highest in the mix and then everything else should be a bit lower. I don't know. But
you gotta remember, this is pretty early in the band, too. This is only their second album.
True.
And for a band that's as, you know, fast and loose as this band is, it, you know, when they're recording and stuff like that, like, you can tell that they don't put a lot of emphasis on their vocals, because I don't think any of them are particularly great singers or anything like that. But again, they're just trying to carry their tune, and it might have been a decision on the recording engineer at the time to maybe bury it a little bit, because that's partly, and both this track and Born Cross-Eyed before, that's one of the things I noticed, is like they needed to work on the vocals a little bit. But again, this is early in the band's career. I do believe that they would learn to, you know, that would get better. They learn to hit those notes a little better. But that's partly what sort of hurt those tracks, you know, the last track and this one at the very beginning.
I'm just going off of what I hear from a little bit later in on the album American Beauty, which I believe was like 1972. So that was like 4 years later. And they definitely grew a lot in that short amount of time, and they became better singers. And the mixing on American Beauty is a lot. I wouldn't call it polished, but it's a little more polished than it is here. And I think that's just because here, like you said, this is early on in their career. This is their second album. They probably don't have the budget to be able to record in a proper studio. And that's also maybe why they're blending live tracks with studio tracks. That's all they can really do at this point.
Well, there was a lot of bands at the time. You would get it a lot with like Savoy Brown record or something like that, where they really, really, they had a certain sound when they were live that they had a hard time capturing on stage. So they would try to put as many of live takes in their studio albums, in quotations, so you get like a mix of half and half. Actually, Cream was very much the same way. Their first two albums were largely in the studio, but they were allowed to sort of branch off. The last two, I mean, partly because they couldn't stand each other in the studio any longer, but yeah, they threw in lots and lots of live recordings in there, not just to fill it out, but because these are legitimately some of the best things they ever recorded. And I think that's where the Grateful Dead were why they did that.
Do you think a lot of it too is the energy that they get from the audience, that immediate response from the audience?
I would say I'm pretty certain that's got a lot to do with it, because there is a playoff between them and the audience, and there's a lot more that sort of depends. I mean, yeah, it's got to be the main factor, actually, having the audience there. Because I'm trying to think of, well, you know, there's a lot of, you know, live settings where they wouldn't have necessarily had the time to branch out that they would in the studio. So, yeah, it's got to be that they love that playoff with the audience, and they just like getting an audience to enjoy what they're doing. It's just part of the package for them, certainly at this point in their career.
Yeah. That's because I was just thinking about how, like, a stand-up comedian works, in that and this is where I always saw the difference between comedians and musicians, but maybe the lines are a little bit more blurred than I thought, but a comedian will write a joke or a routine or a bit, and they won't know if it's going to work until they perform it in front of an audience, whereas music I always saw as kind of the opposite, where they could record something and they knew it was going to be okay. But maybe it's that's not exactly how the Grateful Dead works, is maybe they need to try something out live before they know if it's going to work as a song or an idea or a jam or whatever.
Could be. But yeah, I mean, another thing being a comedian would differ that way is that, you know, it would be pretty lame to listen to a comedy album with the comedian sitting in a padded room talking to himself.
Yeah.
You might as well become a radio DJ.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, and maybe he is still funny, but the energy is just completely different. And a lot of comedians really, really, really depend on an audience's reaction to really get, you know, the point across. I mean, it is a give and take. It's basically a conversation. I mean, only one of them has a microphone, but the reaction is the other half of the conversation.
Mm-hmm. And I'm starting to think that the Grateful Dead and bands like them kind of work the same way, which is cool. I mean, you know, you can be a band like U2, where it's a lot of heavy studio production. Or you can do this, where it's not so much. I mean, this album has, especially the earlier tracks, they had a lot of fun in the studio making sounds. But I don't think that's where the Grateful Dead's strengths are. I think their strengths are playing live and getting that audience feedback,
being able to flesh it out in front of an audience too. It's interesting because there's a lot of musicians that would not feel comfortable doing that. And it seems the Grateful Dead are at their best when they take like a nugget of an idea and actually turn it into something in front of an audience. Like, you know, it's barely a thing until the concert's over. So,
and I know bands do that. They'll set up and jam until an idea comes out, but they won't do it in front of people.
Yeah, exactly. But some bands just need that audience input.
Yeah, cool. I'm glad I realized that. Just listening to this and talking it out, because I never paid much attention to the Grateful Dead. Mm-hmm.
We all know driving that train high on cocaine, because that's the one that's all over the radio.
Yeah.
Or it was anyway.
But hearing the way that they, and I can hear their influence on later bands too. But I can also hear, like I said, the influence that they had, especially the earlier tracks on this album from Brian Wilson. It's interesting to hear, like, they're sort of the unsung heroes in rock, in that I think they only had like one or two big hits, but they had a whole career and made a whole career of having a following. But I think a lot of other bands that were more popular than them consider them an influence.
Absolutely.
Kind of happens a lot, and it's not fair.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I've never talked to Jerry Garcia or Bob Weir about how they necessarily felt about kind of having, like, you know, I wouldn't call it a small following. It's a very big following, but it's not a pop following. It's not mainstream at all.
Yeah.
The name is known. It's a household name, but most people don't really, you know, they don't necessarily put I'd say they wouldn't put a sound to it. They got an idea of a sound to it, but they don't necessarily have a well-fleshed-out idea of the sound that they think. They have a basic idea of what, it's a Grateful Dead, they do that. But, yeah, again, it takes a certain amount, a certain type of person to really get it, and that person is not turning on pop radio.
Yeah. And I think everybody knows some of the aesthetics of the band too, like the skull with the lightning bolt and some of the logos that they use.
The walking teddy bears.
Yeah. I think people know those. I don't know if they know what it's associated with. So I think
they see them on the backs of cars and
right.
Go, well, there's a deadhead.
Yeah.
If
they know what a deadhead is, I think their iconography and their aesthetics sort of transcend the band. And it's, I don't know if any other band has that.
I'd say the closest thing would be probably the Rolling Stones and their tongue, their lips and tongue. That'd probably be like the closest thing that's come to mind. There's probably other ones out there. I guess Nirvana and their happy face with the tongue out and X'd out eyes, maybe that. But yeah, that's probably pretty, that's a fairly good parallel.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah. So we've got one more track. This is the fifth song on the album.
Yep. Second longest.
It's called Caution, Do Not Stop on the Tracks. Neat.
Yeah, it was just like, caution, do not stop on tracks, and then we get a train wreck.
Basically, yeah. That was something.
Wild.
Yeah.
I know I'm going to have to go back and listen to this album in, like, all the songs in sequence, because you can definitely tell where this last track was a continuation of the previous track.
Yeah, and I was just going to say that I didn't really care for this song, and I think it's because, you know, we took a pause between the two to talk about it, obviously, and I think it's because it lacked the build-up to where it was. And I think it's here's the jam.
It's not a standalone track.
Exactly. So I think you need to hear both Alligator and Caution together in order to get into it. So I found myself kind of like, this isn't that great, but I think it's just because I didn't have the build up. It wasn't building up to where it was. It was already there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I mean, it was definitely, there's a lot of interesting things going on in there. You know, still a lot of great sounds, a lot of really strange sounds. Yeah, towards the end. I mean, we weren't entirely sure when it was going to actually end. It got pretty quiet there, but there was still like a good 2 or 3 minutes left on the track. And then, of course, probably Jerry Garcia's guitar started to come in with some feedback and springy sounds.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think you made the comment, and I thought the same thing, as it reminded me of some of the stuff. Well, like, we would had a band in high school, and we would jam in your basement. And
we made some pretty strange sounds.
Yeah.
I found out that if I turn my amp just up to 4, I could have a big Fender Super Twin. And, you know, as it's known for being a stupidly loud amp, not necessarily one of the greatest sounding amps. I don't think it sounds that bad, honestly. But, yeah, I usually had it at about 3, and that's plenty. But if I turned it up to 4, I could get some pretty crazy sounds out
yeah.
of it.
Yeah. And I remember,
and yeah, that's what we were doing.
Yeah, I remember you had that phase shifter, and we would turn that all the switches on that, and then do that with the feedback. We could get some pretty funky sounds doing that
yeah.
too.
The old Maestro phase shifter, and I also had that bank of switches. I had what was it? Well, anyway, there was a delay in there, and there was a chorus attached to it, and things like that. But yeah, I especially liked having the delay in conjunction with, what was the, I have to look at the damn thing again. But yeah, especially with having like, the delay and something or other playing in conjunction with it. I think it was maybe, maybe it was an echo or something like that. No. What was it? I don't remember. Anyway. Yeah. We would get like these thrumming repeating sounds, and they would just like turn into this echoing loop, but it wasn't like a screeching feedback loop. It was this rum, 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 rum. It sounded like a big engine of some sort.
Yeah.
So They didn't quite do that on this track, but
no.
Those sort of sounds kind of remind me of some of the things we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
You can tell that it was loud, you know. Was that one recorded in a studio, or is that actually the end of the live track?
That was, I think that was two live tracks. Sort of edited together.
Oh, okay. Well, anyway, that would have been a pretty loud show on the stage. I'm quite
certain. Yeah, it would have been. I would have loved to see this band in like 1970.
Yeah, yeah.
That would have been so much fun.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still not sure how I feel about this album though.
Mm-hmm.
I don't.
Yeah, it's got some ups and it's got some downs. I'm probably going to throw it in my other collection.
Mm-hmm.
Of stuff from this period, just because I think it belongs and there is some high points. But yeah, again, it's early in the band. There's ideas there, but they're not as tight as they would become. They needed more rehearsing. It wasn't as they had some growing to do still.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
Yeah, I think certainly drugs played a part in this
producing and enjoying.
And enjoying, yeah. I don't think this album or this, maybe even this band, but I don't think this album could exist without drugs. Like LSD. I'm not talking about hard stuff like cocaine and heroin, but you know, like the psychedelic stuff. That's okay. I mean, I think that works for the, cause they were huge in that San Francisco scene.
Mm-hmm.
Again,
they had a huge following, but they weren't, Big Brother and the Holding Company or, what's another really big one from that scene? Oh, actually,
Jefferson Airplane.
Jefferson Airplane. That's the other really big one. Yeah.
Yeah. But they were around. They played Woodstock, didn't they? I'm not sure.
It sounds like the sort of place where they would. They're not featured in the movie, I don't think.
I'm positive they did, but I'm starting to wonder if they were even big enough to play Woodstock.
Yeah, I don't think. Again, they weren't like a big draw name. They sort of had to build on that. They had a following, a really rabid following, but it wasn't a pop following. And Woodstock was very much a pop festival. It would have been, a great concert, but yeah, it was a pop festival.
Yeah, they did play Woodstock.
Oh, they did. Yeah, okay.
I'm surprised. I was sure they did. It's been a while since I've even really thought about Woodstock, to be honest.
Mm-hmm. I know Canned Heat played it.
Yeah.
For sure. So, yeah.
Grateful Dead may have been one of the most famous performers at Woodstock, but their set didn't exactly knock it out of the park. So they did play Woodstock, but they were kind of, I guess, forgettable for the people that were there. But
I can see that.
Yeah. This album, I'm more familiar with their, not their later stuff, like the 80s stuff, but like, I think American Beauty, like I said before, is what I'm familiar with. And I honestly think I prefer that album just because it's a little more put together. It's a little more focused and a little more, this is fun to listen to, but it's kind of directionless.
that's a good way to put it. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it's not a concept album by any stretch of the imagination, but I do think there was an idea sort of behind it, but it meanders a lot.
I don't think this will be an album that I won't listen to again. I just think it's going to be something that I have to be in the right mood for.
Yeah.
And I think it's good. It's something that you have to listen to from beginning to end. I don't think it's something you can just listen to one or two songs from.
Yeah, I think sooner rather than later, I'm probably going to put it on and play right through it nonstop as much as I can. Just to, get a better feel of it. And I might come back with another different take on it. We'll see. I don't know.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see how you feel about it, like, the next listen. Because maybe it's one of those things that takes a few times to listen to before you go, oh, okay, I get it. I know what they're doing. I don't know. But it's interesting either way.
Yeah, I think so. That seems to have been I think that sort of wraps up this album.
Yeah. So yeah, overall, I thought it was cool, but something
it's not everybody's cup of tea, exactly. Not by any stretch. Yeah, it's
yeah. There you go.
So, you're a Grateful Dead fan, or you won't know what the hell's going on.
Exactly.
I'm sort of in between.
Yeah, me too, really. Well, all right. Well, if there's nothing else, thank you so much for listening if you made it this far. And hopefully you'll join us next time. And I hope you have a great week. I'm Jeremy Boyd.
I'm John Van Dyke.
Take it easy.
You have been listening to Polyphonic Press. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Polyphonic Press. Check out the website, polyphonicpress.com. Feel free to drop us a line at polyphonicpressmusic@gmail.com. And finally, you can support the show by heading over to patreon.com/polyphonicpress.